Great. My name is Fred Wilson. I'll be the hearings official for today's public hearing. This is the time set aside for the public hearing in the Alberta Abbey case. File number is LU19-137608HPR. This is a continued hearing, so some of you might have been here a while ago, but today is an opportunity for people to give testimony, to present evidence, to make legal arguments. I don't make a final decision today. There'll be a later written decision that comes out after the record's been closed. There are a few things I need to talk about before every public hearing. I need to disclose if I've had any ex parte contacts, that's any discussions about the merits of the case before today, and I haven't. The only thing I know about this case is what I've received from the planning department that's in the planning file and the staff report. I also need to disclose whether I'm biased, whether I'm for or against the application for any reason other than the merits of the case. I'm not. I'm not familiar with the parties or the property. I don't have any reason to feel one way or the other. Finally, I need to disclose I have any conflicts of interest. I don't. I'm in private practice in Salem. I don't have any private clients in the city of Portland, let alone anywhere near the subject property. I don't own property in Portland or have family that owns property in Portland. If you haven't been to one of these hearings before, the way it's going to work is we will start with the staff report. After the staff report, the applicant will have an opportunity to present their case. After that, anyone who is in favor of the application wants to testify can go. After that, people who are opposed to the application can testify. Then we'll have a chance for staff to respond to any issues that come up. And finally, the applicant will have an opportunity for final rebuttal. There are a few things under state and local code that I need to talk about. If you do testify, first of all, please give us your name and address and spell your last name so we have that for the record. Also, please make sure you raise any and all issues you may have. If you don't raise those issues, you may be precluded from raising them in the future if there are any further proceedings or appeals of this case. Also, please direct your testimony to the approval criteria. Those are the only things I can make my decision based upon. They are listed in the staff report, so even if you have wonderful arguments about why something is a terrible idea, if it doesn't apply to the approval criteria, I still have to approve it. On the other hand, even if I think this is the best project I've ever heard of, if it doesn't meet all of the approval criteria, I still can't approve it. Also, if the applicant, if you have any concerns about proposed conditions of approval, make sure you raise those issues or you may be precluded from raising those in the future. If you haven't turned off your cell phone, this would be a good time to do it. If you wish to request that the record be left open or the hearing continued, make sure you do that when you testify. And unless we have any preliminary matters to take care of, which I don't think we do, then we can turn to the staff report.
Good morning. My name is Amanda Rhodes. My address is, that's R-H-O-A-D-S, and my address is 1900 Southwest 4th, Portland, Oregon, 97201. I'm the staff planner for this case, LU19-137608HPRAD. For 126 Northeast Alberta Street. And this hearing is for a historic preservation incentive review with one concurrent adjustment review. Here's a quick outline of my presentation. I'm going to go over the zoning of the site and then the requested proposal, give a few photos of the site context, walk through the approval criteria, and then present the staff recommendation. So here's the zoning map for the site, which shows this zoning on the property as R1, or multi-dwelling residential 1000. As a Portland historic landmark, the site also has the historic resource protection overlay zoning. The 10,000 square foot site is roughly two blocks west of the Martin Luther King Jr. corridor to the east and the North Williams Avenue corridor to the west. The next slide has an aerial of roughly the same area, which shows the church site in the middle, outlined in blue, surrounded by primarily single dwelling zoning in the single dwelling development in the single dwelling zone. And you'll see the density of development increases to the east along MLK. And then we've got single dwelling zoning in multi-dwelling zones, and then some bigger development to the west along the Williams-Vancouver corridor. So I'm going to walk through the request in a little more detail. This request is for approval of historic preservation incentives. The purpose for these incentives are to increase the potential for historic resources to be used, protected, renovated, and preserved through greater flexibility and economic opportunities. In this case, since the site is now zoned R1 and formerly had a legal non-residential use as a church, it is eligible for incentive number 8, which allows up to the entire net building area to be used for retail sales and service, office, or manufacturing and production uses. So again, in order to be eligible for these incentives, the site must have 3 things. First, it must be a designated historic resource. The Mallory Avenue Christian Church, now called Alberta Abbey, was designated a Portland Historic Landmark on January 11th, 2019 for its significance in post-war modernist architecture. Second, for this incentive, the site must be zoned multi-dwelling R1, R2, or RH. The site was rezoned from R2.5 to R1 by City Council back in 2018. And third, the last use on the property must have been non-residential. The only use approved through city permits on the site in our records has been a church, which is considered a religious institution use. Religious institutions are considered conditional uses in residential zones. The church operated in the building until 2012. At the end of 2012, it was sold, and at that point, the religious institution stopped operating, and the new owners established the retail and office uses without benefits of permit. And per zoning code section 33.815.050, all conditional use status was lost after 3 years. The current owners and applicants are requesting to use the entire building for retail sales and service and office uses, including a performance space in the main auditorium, workspaces for artists and arts organizations, a cafe and a basement gym, and other spaces for event rentals. Parking requirements must be met when the uses of a building are changed. While sites within 500 feet of a transit street with 20-minute peak hour service have no parking required for the proposed uses, the subject site is 520 feet from the Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard corridor. Therefore, 133 spaces are required to allow these new uses in the building. This chart shows the required parking broken out by use. The general office is considered office. The other 3 categories are all under the retail, sales, and service use, but their parking requirements are calculated differently. And you can see that the large number is primarily driven by the theater and auditorium, for which the required parking is based on the number of seats rather than square footage like the other uses. The applicant has requested an adjustment to fully waive the required parking for the site. So now I'll show you some photos of the site and the surrounding area. And there's a little map in the right-hand corner with an arrow to kind of orient you to our view. This view is the northeast corner of the church at Northeast Alberta and Northeast Mallory Avenue. The 3 doors at the base of the tower there are the main entrance to the theater and the cafe. This is the east side of the building. The main east-facing entrance accesses, that's got the canopy here, accesses activities in the basement. This is most of the east side of the building. No exterior changes to the building have been proposed as part of this review, and any future proposed changes would be subject to the regulations for historic resources. And then I've got a few images of some nearby streets that give a hint to the neighborhood and also the available on-street parking. This image is along Northeast Alberta looking west with the church building on our left, and Northeast Alberta in this area has no on-street parking. This is looking north on Northeast Mallory. South on Northeast Mallory with the church on the right there. And you can see the residential development on the east side. And then Rodney, 1 block to the west. This is Northeast Rodney to looking south. There's a multi-dwelling development on the right and single dwelling houses on the left. And then looking north. So now, moving to the approval criteria. The 3 approval criteria that apply to the historic preservation incentive portion of the review are listed here. Criterion 1 refers to whether the proposal is in alignment with the King neighborhood plan. Criterion 2 applies to residently zoned sites. 2A requires that the approval criteria for conditional uses in residential zones are met. Criterion B doesn't apply because the site is less than 1 acre in size. And then Criterion 3 requires that the owner executes a covenant with the City of Portland that states that the owner agrees the historic resource is subject to demolition review and the owner will not demolish or relocate the historic resource without city approval. To address Criterion 1, staff reviewed the King neighborhood plan and found that several of the objectives were aligned with the proposal. Those objectives centered on protecting historic resources in the King neighborhood, developing the King neighborhood's role as a tourist attraction, establishing an art center in King, and creating opportunities for artists and entertainers to live and work in the King neighborhood. Staff concluded that the proposal supported these objectives and that no other objectives were in conflict with the proposal. Therefore, staff found this criterion was met. Criterion 2 refers us to another set of approval criteria, the findings for which make up the bulk of the staff report, and I'll walk through those next. So the appropriate conditional use approval criteria are for institutional and other uses in residential and campus institutional zones, found in 33815105. So criterion A looks at the proportion of household living uses, specifically that the overall residential appearance and functioning of the residential area will not be significantly lessened due to the increased proportion of non-residential uses. The defined residential area is a mixture of single and multi-dwelling development. The Alberta Abbey would be the only non-residential use in that defined residential area, so the proportion of non-residential uses is small compared with the number of residential uses. The church building has been located on the site since 1949, and no exterior changes are proposed, so there will be no change in appearance to the residential neighborhood with the approval of this review. The criterion also looks at the intensity and the scale of the proposal. The number and size of events that the building could accommodate could have broad implications for the functioning of the residential area. Therefore, conditions of approval have been proposed to limit the intensity of the use. First, a condition has been proposed to limit the number of people allowed on site at any one time to 250, with the exception that up to 8 times a year, up to 330 people may be allowed. And second, a condition would require the applicant to implement the proposed transportation demand management plan to limit cars coming to the site. The Bureau of Transportation, or PBOT, proposed both conditions, and they are discussed in more depth in the staff report under Criterion D. With these two conditions, staff found this criterion can be met. Criterion B looks at physical compatibility, specifically whether the proposal will be compatible with the adjacent residential development, or if it's not, it'll mitigate differences in appearance and scale through setbacks, landscaping, tree preservation, or other design features. Staff found that the proposal allows for adaptive reuse of a local historic landmark on a small-scale site. The building is a traditional neighborhood church in terms of form, scale, and massing. Because of this and the fact that no changes are proposed to the exterior of the building, staff concluded that criterion B can be met. Criterion C looks at livability impacts for neighboring properties, including noise, glare from lights, late-night operations, odors, litter, privacy, and safety. Staff found that the proposal would not create impacts in noise, glare from lights, odors, litter, or privacy based on the information in the record. And staff proposed conditions of approval to address late night operations and safety, which I'll walk through. So first, staff proposed a condition limiting late night hours such that all events and gatherings held at Alberta Abbey must end by 11 o'clock p.m., with the exception that up to 12 events per calendar year could run until midnight. These times and limits were determined both from a consideration of standard night hours determined by Title 18, our noise control title, and an analysis of ending times of events at the site over the past 2 years. Second, staff recognized that safety concerns exist for the surrounding properties as long as the new proposed occupancies of the building are not addressed through building permits that verify life safety standards are met. Usually in a circumstance like this, the city requires that all permits be final before the new approved use commences in the building. In this case, previous owners started the new uses without benefit of permit. The current owners did take initial steps in mid-2019 to explore what the required permits will involve, but no applications have been submitted, and the applicant's representative has indicated that the scope of work is likely to be significant, and it may not be feasible for them to undertake that right away. Staff discussed permitting with the plans examiner, who has had conversations with Alberta Abbey through 2019 to come up with a reasonable timeline for the completion of the work. Taking the Abbey's concerns into account, staff recommended a condition of approval that the required change of occupancy permits are issued within 6 months and finaled within 12 months of final local approval of this review. This way, the proposed condition allows the Abbey time to complete work without requiring them to cease operations until that work is completed. With these two conditions of approval, staff found that criterion C could also be met. The adequacy of public services was addressed for criterion B by the Police Bureau, Environmental Services, PBOT, Water, and Fire. All service agencies except PBOT found that public services are adequate to serve the proposed use with no conditions. PBOT reviewed the transportation analysis provided by the applicant's transportation engineers and, based on the on-street parking analysis, developed the following two conditions that staff has included. First, PBOT proposed no events for more than 250 attendees at a time, with the exception that up to eight times a year, 330-person events could occur. Considering the number of spaces that one could host concurrent activities in on-site and the added pressure this would put on the on-street parking, staff modified this recommended condition to limit the number of people on the entire site at the same time to 250, with that same exception going up to 330. And then more than 330 people on site would be prohibited at any one time. Second, PBOT recommended that the proposed transportation demand management plan be implemented. This includes a website with information on transit, biking, a map of bike parking nearby, and a link to TriMet's trip planner, among other things. With these two conditions, staff found this criterion could be met. And finally, condition E is looking at the proposal in terms of whether it's consistent with any adopted area plans. So I discussed in criterion one, the King neighborhood plan. The site is also within the Albina community plan area. And the proposal is consistent with many of the objectives under business growth and development and community image and character. However, certain objectives also address buffering residential areas from negative impacts of commercial developments or activities. As discussed earlier, several proposed conditions of approval ensure that the proposal is aligned with these objectives, including the condition to limit the number of people on site at any one time, and the condition limiting late night hours for events. So with those conditions, found that this criterion could also be met. So now we're back to the historic preservation incentive review criteria, and to meet criterion three, a condition was placed to require the applicant to execute the required covenant within a month of the final local decision. With this condition, staff found the criterion could be met. And now quickly, we'll just move on to the requested adjustment to waive the required parking. The approval criteria are listed here. Criterion C isn't relevant because only one adjustment was requested, which leaves the following considerations: whether the proposal equally meets the purpose of the regulations, whether the proposal affects livability and appearance of the residential area, whether city-designated historic and scenic resources are preserved, and whether the impacts have been mitigated. And my full findings for the adjustment are available in the staff report, but in summary, due to the proximity to frequent service transit, good street connectivity, good pedestrian facilities, and with the proposed conditions of approval to limit the number of people on the site at a given time, to limit the late night operations of the proposed uses, and to require the applicant to implement the proposed transportation demand management plan, staff found that the adjustment to waive the requirement of 133 parking spaces to serve the proposed uses could be granted without impacts to neighboring properties. As discussed in the staff report, the proposal is also found to be consistent with the statewide land use planning goals. So before the staff report came out, staff had received 22 sets of written comments. One was a petition signed by 76 people. Others were emails of support or letters of support for the proposal. We did get a number of concerns from neighbors, which primarily addressed parking impacts to the neighborhood, emergency vehicle access when streets are parked up, and the potential development of the lot across the street. Out of those, only the parking impacts were directly relevant to the approval criteria. And then since the staff report was published, the hearings office received several letters in support of the applicant's request to continue the hearing from January until today. And then the King Neighborhood Association submitted a letter providing feedback on two of the proposed conditions of approval. They recommended allowing larger events if the applicant could secure shared parking agreements, and they thought a longer time horizon than 1 year should be allowed for building permits to be finalized. So I've already gone through them all, but here's all the list of the recommended conditions of approval all together. And given these findings, the staff recommendation is approval of the historic preservation incentive, approval of the adjustment, and those both approvals are subject to the conditions of approval. And that's the end.
Okay, thank you. I don't think I have any questions. So now's the opportunity for the applicant to present their case.
Do you want me to jump right into your...
Yeah, just the first slide will do. Good morning, Hearings Officer Wilson. My name is Damian Hall, last name spelled H-A-L-L. I'm with the law firm of Baljanic at 101 Southwest Main Street, Suite 1100, Portland, Oregon, 97204. I'm here on behalf of the applicant, the Alberta Abbey LLC. We're going to have a number of folks speaking with you today, and I'd just like to introduce them briefly. We have Mark Takaguchi, Executive Director of the Alberta Abbey, along with Jessica Engman, our Historic Preservation Specialist with the Meredith Property Group, and Julia Kuhn, our Transportation Engineer with Kittleson and Associates. Before I invite them up, I'd like to give a quick overview of the legal issues. I'll circle back after the presentations to go into some depth. But we do want to thank the staff for all their hard work in putting together this comprehensive staff report and the great presentation this morning, and also for the recommendation of approval with conditions. The applicant does have some concerns with the conditions of approval, and specifically two of them. Condition B, proposed condition B, which applies the 250-person cap on the site with the exception of 8 times per year. When that cap goes up to 330. And then condition E, which requires the Abbey to obtain and close out a change of occupancy permit within 12 months. We think that the 250-person cap number is untethered from the parking analysis that Kittleson has provided and the evidence in the record. And we think that there's if you take a look at the appropriate effective capacity standards that should be applied for on-street parking, that it results in a different figure, which we'll talk about in some detail. And as to the change of occupancy issue, we don't think that that is related to this land use application at all and should be handled outside of this particular review. It's a creature of the structural codes. It's a building permit issue that will have to be dealt with the city, and the Abbey's not proposing not to proceed with that or with any improvements. However, we don't support a condition of approval, and we especially don't support a condition of approval requiring permits to be pulled and all upgrades to be completed within 12 months, and more to come on that. The high-level summary is that each of those conditions on its own puts the Abbey in a financially untenable posture. The 250-person cap curtails event attendees at ticketed events in the auditorium area. Those revenues or revenues from those events drive operations of the Abbey and put its mission at risk of and Mr. Takaguchi will speak more to the mission, but it's a nonprofit that provides below market space to artists and artist communities. And also the cost of, with condition E, the cost of improvements necessary to close out the change of occupancy permit are anticipated to be prohibitively expensive. Our initial analysis puts us in the multiple millions of dollars in order to achieve that. So we think the 12 months is untenable. So that is an intro. I'd like to invite up Mark Takaguchi to speak a little bit about the mission and operations of the Abbey and the financial impact of some of the of proposed conditions B and E.
Good morning. So my name is Mark Takaguchi, last name T-A-K-I. G-U-C-H-I. Address where I live most of the time is at the Alberta Abbey, 126 Northeast Alberta Street. I've been the executive director there for a little over 8 months. And I do want to give the context of what the Abbey does, because I think it's really important. I think Amanda's done great a lot of effort into this presentation, and PBOT similarly have gone through this process thoughtfully. They've been good in communicating with us. But what I'm asking for and what the Abbey needs is a level of flexibility and a broader scope of what the Abbey is trying to do, specifically in relation to Portland City initiatives such as the Affordable Arts Plan. So our mission is to build a thriving and art and cultural center in Northeast Portland. We offer affordable space. We offer programming opportunities. We connect with communities. We connect with neighbors. And we are trying to be a bulwark against the increasing lack of affordable space for creatives in the city of Portland. We can go into the history of the closing of the Oregon College of Art and Craft, where I worked, the loss of the art gym, et cetera, et cetera. But the creative culture in Portland is under a lot of stress now. And so the Abbey exists as a place where organizations and artists and creative people can come and have some respite from market rates. We've worked really hard to become a resource for these kinds of people, as well as community members and our neighbors. So we are in a very initial stage of our growth as a nonprofit. We have 3 staff for a 25,000 square foot plus building. So we're operating on very thin financial margins to be able to continue our work. We have 9 current tenants, all of whom except one are creative artists and organizations. We have a theater company. We have an acting studio. We have Rose City Ballet. We have artists. Our leases and rental prices are generally about 40% below market, and even at that rate, we still have to turn away people that can't afford us. We typically serve around 800 people a month through our programming, the programming of our partners, the different events and get-togethers that our tenants serve, and our cafe. The other thing that I think that's really important to understand that ties into the initiatives in the city of Portland and beyond is our focus on equity. So our partners include the Oregon Humanities, De La Salle North Catholic High School, Friends of Noise, Fame Academy, which offers education and opportunities for performance for disabled adults, the Portland African American Leadership Forum, the King and Neighborhood Associations are also great partners, and we've got 2 members from those associations here today. I want to be brief and give you 2 quick stories about what the Abbey has done. So Mark Bowden, who's one of our tenants, is a music producer. He, as many people in the music industry, has a day job. Before he moved to the Abbey 2 years ago, he went through 3 different spaces in the course of 3 years. He is so grateful to have a place that's stable, where he doesn't have to worry about the rent increasing 20% or the place being turned into a condo. Through his stability, he was able to produce an event recently, George Harrison's All Things Must Pass 50th anniversary concert, which was amazing, took place at Revolution Hall. He used the stage at the Abbey, which is a very large stage. We are, I wouldn't say unique, but we're unusual in the Northeast Portland neighborhood for having a 400 person capacity theater and a very large stage. He had 30 musicians. He was able to use our space to rehearse for this very large show. And if he hadn't been a tenant and got the tenant discount and had the space, this show might not have happened. The other story I want to share is Meyer Memorial Trust, which I'm sure everybody has heard of, chose us to host a very important event this past fall, which was the Dr. Reverend William Barber came to Portland to build what's a contemporary poor people's campaign. The event was sold out almost immediately. We had over 400 requests for tickets. The reason that Meyer chose us was our location in a historically black neighborhood, our capacity of 400, and I want to emphasize that. If we are required to reduce our capacity to events to 250 for most events or even 330, an event like the Meyer Memorial Trust would not have happened. They would have had to find a different venue for it. And I think maybe even more importantly than the cost that some of these limitations have to our budget, which are significant, we have a $400,000 annual budget, is the impact that we are starting to have and we want to grow within our community, broader community of Portland and the specific Albina neighborhood. So, I mean, the recommendations as existed, it, by my calculations, would reduce over the last 2 years our revenue by over $5,000 annually. And this is happening at a time when we need to grow. And as you've heard I think Mai will talk more about this, but the certificate of occupancy timeline with a year and with a potential budget that's in the millions of dollars, you know, you guys can do the math. We have a $400,000 annual budget. We have three staff. We're just starting fundraising. So what we're asking for in relation to that is not that we are exempted from requirements of safety. We're asking for a longer timeline, and we also need to address the impacts that kind of work are going to have on our tenants, who also have businesses they need to run, and on the programming. And so asking for a longer timeline and any flexibility, recognizing that this is a historic building that was built over 80 years ago, would allow us to continue. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Mark. And now if Jessica, if you come up, she's our historic preservation specialist and helped the Abbey obtain landmark status.
Yes, Jessica Ingeman, E-N-G-E-M-A-N at 1111 Northeast Flanders, Suite 206, Portland, Oregon, 97232. In addition to being a historian, my role at Meritus Property Group is also project manager, and my firm did redevelop or rehabilitate the aforementioned Revolution Hall, which also took advantage of this incentive review process, which was vital to kind of saving that historic resource. So I just want to touch on a few things here. From my work on the landmark application, you know, staff has obviously already said that this building is significant as a church for its architecture. It's also significant for its important role in Portland's African-American community. So when this portion of the church was built in 1949, the church had a congregation of 560 people. They had these facilities could handle up to 700 people at a time. And my research showed through archives of the church, as well as articles in the Oregonian, they held weddings, funerals, banquets, church teas, charitable luncheons, special events, concerts, musical programs, plays, conventions, leadership training seminars, lectures, youth nights, different types of community meetings, choir rehearsals, film screenings, and they also had a significant amount of after-school sports programming, summer youth programming. And I just share that with you to help demonstrate that this building has for a long time been a hub in the community and had quite a lot of activity going on at this particular corner at Alberta and Mallory. Thinking a little bit about the goals of this historic preservation review, which is to increase the potential for historic landmarks like this building to be used, protected, renovated, and preserved. I also want to chime in, particularly with a lens that I look at this as a developer of historic buildings, and that the conditions of approval B and E are terribly complicated in allowing for the economic viability of this building to actually meet that goal of using, protecting, renovating, and preserving the historic resource. And I think you'll hear this from other people, that this change of occupancy permit timeline and the costs associated with that is just truly not something that can be done. And pulling permits in 6 months and finaling in 12 months is just not possible.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Jessica. And turn it over to Julia Kuhn, our traffic engineer with Kittleson, to respond to PWAT's parking analysis.
Good morning. My name is Julia Kuhn. Last name is spelled K-U-H-N. I'm a senior principal at Kittleson Associates. Our address is 851 Southwest 6, Suite 600, Portland 97204. Within the record, you'll see three documents from us that are of relevance to my testimony today. One is a March 2019 report that discusses the approval criteria as well as both during an event and a night in which an event wasn't happening in February 2019, what the on-street parking conditions were like as well as the off-street. A June 2019 memo that talks about what happened during a May 2019 all-day bluegrass festival that was projected to have about 400 attendees, and at the peak time it was about 250-ish. And then a November 2019 memo that talks a little bit more about on-street capacity analysis, as well as makes a number of recommendations related to the need for transportation demand management and trip planning options for the Abbey to implement, which they have since implemented. So based on the review that we've done, our testimony today relates to respectfully requesting that you revisit the cap on the number of events of 330 attendees on the site. That when there are three primary bases for our recommendation. One is, as we understand it, the recommended conditional approval from PBOT is based on what we call an 85% effective capacity of on-street spaces. And I'm going to get a little technical for a minute, so feel free to ask me questions. Okay. So we do a lot of parking review, and there's oftentimes what you want to make sure when you have parking supply, both on-street or off-street, that you don't use 100% of the parking, because people turn over spaces, people are looking for spaces. In a retail or downtown environment, you typically strive for an 85% full, because you want to have spaces available for customers, for people to easily access businesses, but also make a judicious use of space. You don't want to have an empty parking field either. For institutions, oftentimes hospitals, campuses, when you're talking about peak time, oftentimes we use a 90 to 95% full, recognizing that people are kind of captive, they're on site. And our November analysis was based on, rather than an 85% full standard, a 90% full standard of the, and so that says, take the supply, multiply it by 0.9, and that is effectively what your capacity is that we're striving for. So with a 90% full standard used for the on-street rather than 85%, what that in fact does is bumps up the number of event patrons that could be accommodated. The other piece that goes into that is try to figure out how do you convert number of parking spaces to number of event patrons. And we did some analysis at the two different events that we measured. One that said, on average, about 2.5 people per car. The other one used 2.7 people per car. There's been other studies recently about other events looking across the city, sports events, concerts, different things, exceeding 2.5 people per car. What we're suggesting is that you use 2.5 as kind of a reasonably conservative threshold for converting parking spaces to the number of event patrons. So if you follow that math still, you're still with me. And then we add in, we've got on-street parking, and then the Abbey also has shared parking rights to the 23 spaces that are across the street from the church itself. So if you include both the 23 off-street spaces plus the 90% full, you get to, if you follow my math, and it's outlined in our November memo, so you don't have to remember all of this, it gets to 382 people on site at any one time. An 85% threshold gets you to 338 patrons when including the 23 off-site spaces. So both of them are more than the condition B that's imposed by the staff report. So we're asking for both the 90% as well as the 23 off-street spaces. Although it hasn't been we haven't been successful yet. The Abbey is continuing to look for other off-site, off-street spaces available within a short walking distance. And we'll keep you posted on that. But for purposes of our analysis, we're only assuming you've got the on-street capacity plus the 23 spaces that are already.
So there's an actual parking agreement for the 23?
That's my understanding, yep.
Correct.
Okay.
So with all that considered, the Abbey, and Damien will go into this in more detail and give you the exact language we're looking for, but we're asking, Abbey is asking for the condition of approval to be slightly modified to say no more than 5 times per calendar year shall the Abbey exceed 350 patrons on site. And that basis is when no additional off-street parking is available through another shared use that has not been confirmed yet. If we get another shared use agreement for use of a specific event or for several events, that they could increase that 350 based on the number of off-street spaces that are available using that same 90% effective capacity in the 2.5 spaces.
And there's somewhere where you've got this all written down.
Yeah, it's
proposed.
All written. Yep. Yeah, the condition, yes. Damien will give you the written condition, okay. And then the analysis is in our November 2019 memo.
Okay.
So you can follow all the math there. And so I realize it's a lot more technical than my presentations typically are, which you've heard a couple of them already. So the last piece I wanted to just point out to you is as you'll see in our November memo, we actually looked at a number of different websites for event venues around the city and kind of chose what we felt was of the best options to give people a lot of information about pre-trip planning, non-encouraging, single occupancy vehicle travel to the site, non-auto travel to the site, and those are outlined in our November memo. Mark let us know that the Abbey has actually put those up on the website already, so they're already in use. So we've already fulfilled that condition of approval. With that, I'll take any questions you might have.
Okay. I think I follow you. Do we have PBOT here today? So
yeah.
Maybe we'll discuss the 85 versus 90% because that'll obviously make a difference. So maybe if that comes up, I can ask you in rebuttal about that. So
perfect. Thank you.
We can go to the next slide, please. And then that was the project team. You just met them. Aren't they wonderful? Let's go to the next slide. All right, so just jumping into a detailed discussion. This is going to focus on proposed conditions B and E, as mentioned. Condition B, again, being the cap on site, cap of the number of people on site based on on-street parking capacity. I just want to sort of set the context based on the actual code standards that the staff report relies on to apply this condition, and it's 33.815.105 sub D sub 2, and the language is that the transportation system is capable of supporting the proposed use in addition to the existing uses in the area. That is the general standard. That standard goes on to list 12 evaluation factors when determining whether or not that standard is met. One of those evaluation factors is on-street parking impacts. It's worth noting that the staff report has zero concern expressed about 11 out of 12 of those factors. The only issue is with on-street parking impacts. That same standard goes on to say that the evaluation factors may be balanced. So, before you even get into the technical analysis, and we will a little bit more, the context is that I believe we have agreement with staff that 11 out of the 12 factors are satisfied. We have one factor outstanding. I wouldn't presume to tell the hearings officer how to balance those factors, but I believe that an effective balance does not result in elevating one factor above the other 12 and significantly diminishing the capacity for events and ticketed event revenue of the Alberta Abbey. So I think that even without getting into the details of 85 versus 90% effective capacity on the streets and you know, coming up with a ratio for shared parking and how that should be factored, I think that we can get to a point of there probably is not a necessity for a condition of approval here based on a hard cap on the amount of folks that can attend this events at the Abbey. Next slide, please. So discussing a couple of those issues, I'll go over these quickly because Julia just very effectively went through the same materials. So the effective capacity threshold, we think 90% is more appropriate. But if you take a look at 85%, the standard that PBOT purports to be applying, the condition B is even more strict than 85%. Why that is, I'm not sure. Again, the 250-person cap is not consistent with the record. The analysis does not appear to consider the shared parking that's available. That's at 23 stalls across the street. And the analysis in the record, the parking analysis provided by Kittleson, applies to event attendees. One thing that's been done in the staff report that's reflected in the recommended condition is to apply that to all persons on the site. So the Alberta Abbey is a building that has more than one thing happening in it. As you know, as has been described, there's a coffee shop, there's some nonprofit offices, an artist space, and then there's a larger area where events can happen. So the analysis that was done that went into the on-street parking information in the record did not look at total number of people on the site. However, and it's uncertain why, but at some point along the line, I don't think in PBOT's recommendation, but in staff's for BDS's interpretation of the recommendation, the recommendation became a cap on everyone on site. So there's not only are we what's proposed more strict than the 85% threshold, it's then once again more strict than being applied to only event attendees. So tried to simplify the numbers as far as the effective capacity with and without off-street parking. You'll see on the next slide, we're proposing a cap at 350 patrons based on the existing parking rights. And then if new parking rights are obtained, that we can go up from that based on the amount of additional off-street stalls. That 350 comes in slightly above 85, but well below 90%. It's not an aggressive position that Alberta Abbey is seeking to have no restrictions at all. We're really trying to find some common ground here, and we think that the 250, as mentioned, is inconsistent with the record and the own PBOT's own standards that it's applying. Next slide. So here's the proposed condition. You wanted it in writing, but basically 350 peak occupancy cap, and then the ability to go above that based on additional parking rights, but then also five times per calendar year. And it's, as you can tell, it's couched as being related to peak occupancy of events and not really just sort of the underlying concept of who can be on the site. We think that gives us the flexibility on a going forward basis to continue to seek discussions, as there's a number of surface parking lots within walking distance, but that involves third parties. We've been able to obtain one such agreement. We're in two other discussions to get such agreements. We think that we can that it's achievable, but unclear if that can happen. It hasn't happened yet, and unclear if it can happen in, you know, the next month or so. But we'll be trying to be doing that, and then has the added benefit of not putting the Abbey out of business. So next slide, please.
Oh, so just so on the ones, so you're saying basically 350, up to 350 for every event, mm-hmm. you know, potentially, and then five times you can exceed 350. And what's the, and you said the maximum capacity is around 400?
Yeah, the maximum capacity of the church auditorium area is 400.
So you don't need to, you wouldn't want to put a, because I think the proposed condition has a, even when you have the additional events, it still puts a, it still caps it. So you mm-hmm. don't, you're suggesting no actual cap for those five events, but you're sort of limited by the 400 or so capacity.
Correct.
Okay.
So yeah.
Sure, and, I understood that.
And, you know, there's fire code and what the fire marshal would say, and we're, you know, not proposing to exceed anything
okay.
along those lines. There are limitations on how many folks
okay.
we can put in there. But we just don't feel similar to condition E. We don't feel the need that it, those external limitations be spelled out in conditions of approval in this land use proceeding.
Okay.
So
just making sure they're like not five events with 10,000 people kind of thing. So, you know, obviously not that many, but
yeah, understood.
Something crazy. Okay.
Understood. So proposed condition E, just refresher on that. It is, a condition of approval that would require a building permit application to be submitted within 6 months for a change of occupancy. And for that work required to complete that building permit to be done within another 6 months, so 12 months total. It's not clear to me exactly how that interacts with any land use standards. I think it's outside of the, of what our review is here today. The two standards that I've presented are the conditional use standards and then just a general condition of approval standard. Those seem to be the two standards relied upon by the staff in the staff report. And I'd like to go into those in turn. 33A15105 sub C sub 2. The proposal will not have significant adverse impacts on the livability of nearby residential zoned lands due to safety issues. Safety issues appear in the findings to break down into two general buckets. One is that staff would like the upgrades to the historic building for a generalized sense of safety in the neighborhood, I guess. And the other one, which is repeated a number of times, is that there was one letter about an alleged fight that happened on an unspecified evening. So I'd like to kind of break both of those concepts down because I think they depart from what the actual code standards are. Again, we're talking about interior improvements to an existing building that's been there since the 40s. And that, I believe staff's position is absent those interior improvements, somehow the current, maintaining the current status quo of this building will result in a significant adverse impact to the livability of residential lands. Again, this building's been there since 1945. It's not clear how that logical gap is bridged. The second part about the safety, and I know this is just a mention and kind of a nod to some testimony about somebody got in a fight at some point. It's hard to understand the, well, first of all, the staff report recognizes that as an isolated incident, and there's no testimony of that having happened at any other time. I don't quite understand the connection between event attendance caps and presenting and preventing fisticuffs. A sort of logical gap that's not bridged by the findings. And the only mention of when this happened was in August. You do have in the record a list of all of the events that have happened since 2017, from 2017 through 2019 at the Abbey. None of the August events have exceeded 250 capacity. So if the point was, which it seems to be from the findings, that more than 250 people could result in some sort of impact consistent with that alleged incident, that's inconsistent with the actual the use of the site. So at risk of belaboring that, I'm going to stop. I'll go on let's do the next slide.
Well, actually, let's go. Well, I hear what you're saying about the first one. So
yeah,
that sort of makes sense. Oh, yeah. So the second one says, I'm looking at page 11 of the staff report. Says 33800070 allows the city to impose conditions to ensure the proposal will conform to the applicable approval criteria mm-hmm. for the review, or to ensure the enforcement of other city regulations. Mm-hmm. What exactly? I'm a little confused exactly what they want you to do for these building code stuff.
So that is an open question, which I think is acknowledged in the staff report, as far as what is the scope of what would be required to close out a change of occupancy permit. We're looking into that and anticipate providing an estimate of what specific list of what those items are and an estimate of those costs. We think that it is significant in the millions of dollars. Why I don't think that 33800.070 compels the hearings officer to apply proposed condition E is that it has nothing to do with timelines. Theoretically, and well, more than theoretically, as you're probably aware, oftentimes there's a catch-all condition that says applicants shall get all required permits, local and state, something along those lines. That's a very typical thing. And that probably, I guess, speaks to the second half of that sentence about ensuring the enforcement of city regulations. But again, I think the issue is that we're trying to apply regulations that are outside of the land use process. We're into the structural code. There's to the extent that this permit is necessary, the city has the ability to enforce its own regulations without a land use condition of approval. As you'll hear later in this presentation, we also have a departure from staff as far as the facts of the historical use and what is or is not allowed on the site. We don't think that it's cut and dry that the site has been operating illegally. We don't think that it has, in fact, at all been operating illegally, and we don't think that there's necessarily a clear-cut case that a change of occupancy permit needs to, be immediately proceeded with. That being said, we have been and continue to want to improve the building and look forward to working with the city to do that. There's a, and I'm forgetting the date, but there's a memorandum from myself to Ms. Rhodes in the record that speaks to sort of the exact code standards from the structural code regarding changes of occupancy and makes two points. One, that this application does not trigger any of those code standards of its own, and therefore there's no reason to apply the condition of approval. And two, that there are questions as to whether or not it's even appropriate to be doing that, is given the scale of what it is that they're requiring. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that. Before we get into sort of rough proportionality issues, I do want to touch on, there's actually no, there's a Nolan issue as well, because we don't have an essential nexus to the purpose of either of those standards for requiring a change of occupancy.
Right. So Ms. Rhodes, how does 33800070 get pulled into this? Because I think I tend to agree with Mr. Hall that if we're talking about the livability, the proposal will not have significant adverse impacts on the livability of nearby residential zone lands. I'm not sure how required improvements inside the Abbey is going to affect safety of other lands.
So I think you don't understand how the safety of the building could affect the nearby residences?
The interior of the Abbey, how that's going to make somebody, down the street unsafe.
So I mentioned in the staff report, things like fire damage, it's not down the street, but the immediate properties nearby could be affected by fires. We've all heard of artist communities burning down. They never got the right sprinkler systems. They never got. So I think the key with this is that anytime a land use review is, or a use issue like this is addressed through zoning, it is assumed that the permits need to happen prior to the use commencing. In this case, the use commenced illegally under prior ownership in 2013, 2012, and this is continuing. So this condition was my effort to bridge a gap between saying, okay, this approval doesn't take effect until these permits are done, so, you know, stop everything you're doing until those permits are done, and trying to say, okay, you know, we're not trying to shut you down. We want to make sure that these things are addressed. We know you had some initial conversations. Those stopped in August. There's been nothing that I can find on the city side for continued conversations and continued efforts towards this end. You know, let's make sure that these get done because they are required, and they are, you know, required for reasons of life safety, but we'll give you some time to work on it. And so I did, Jeffrey Harker is a plans examiner here at the city. He had an initial meeting with them, I think in May, and then there was a follow-up email in August. Both of those are in the case file here, documentation of those. And I spoke with him about kind of timing, and that's where I got this 6 month, 12 month thing, timeline. So.
And that all makes sense that you need to have the appropriate permits and things. It's usually, doesn't it usually get pulled in for some other way, like, you know, you're in violation of what you're supposed to be doing already, and it doesn't usually come in under something a little more general.
Every single decision that we issue requires that all of our conditions are reflected on the building permit plans. We're always, you know, that's a condition that's standard. It's not addressed in the findings. It's something that we're saying this is a requirement, so that, you know, so there's already this connection. Like, we're looking at 070 to say, well, yes, there are other city regulations that you need to address, and you need to kind of talk about this process when you address them. Again, the difference here is that the use already commenced. It's already in violation. It's not under any enforcement action at this time, but they're already violating the building code regulations by operating as they are.
Right. So let's just say for and I understand what you're saying about how it could be a fire hazard and that could affect nearby residential land. Let's say that the building code stuff they need to do, everybody agrees it's not a danger anywhere else. It's just you've got to, you know, sort of dot your I's and cross your T's kind of thing. It's not a danger, but they're still not doing what they're supposed to do. How would you pull that in and make that a condition if you couldn't pull it under the safety thing? Because it seems like that's what we always do. I'm just wondering, you know, Mr. Hall's saying there's no Nolan, there's no nexus. So what's the nexus that allows the city to do that?
So that code section doesn't allow me to do it? That's kind of what I'm looking at. If you don't safety argument, 800-070, conditions may be applied to ensure the enforcement of other city regulations.
Right. And so how is 800-070 applicable to this application? Is it approval criteria?
I'm applying a condition. I don't know.
Okay, I think maybe that's Mr. Hall's point, that mm-hmm. there's no nexus. You don't get to pull that in.
The nexus is we're allowing a use that hasn't been legally permitted.
Okay, so explain more to me about 800-070, like the framework that comes from.
That is in our chapter on just general land use process.
That's the very general statement of
general conditions of on land use.
Yeah, conditions may be applied in these circumstances, separate from any zone, particular zone or particular action.
So this chapter is generally describing the zoning code of discretionary reviews, non-discretionary, an explanation of discretionary reviews, review bodies, the function of approval criteria, the burden of proof, conditions of approval, and land use reviews involving signs. So that's the chapter.
So sort of a general catch-all that allows conditions to be imposed. Okay, thank you.
If I could, Douglas Hardy, Bureau of Development Services. So I think you were hitting on the point in terms of the nexus, number one, to the approval criteria in 33.815. Was specifically related to safety. I think, as Amanda indicated, that the building code is intended for life safety reasons. There's a reason we make people get building permits. When a new use comes into a building, you want to make sure that building is safe, not only for the occupants of the building, but also for surrounding property owners, that it doesn't threaten the livability or safety of abutting properties. We at this point don't necessarily know what aspects of the building meet code requirements and what aspects don't. That's what the building permit is for. So I would argue, and I think we argued in the staff report, that there is a direct nexus to that approval criteria that talks about safety. So if we, through this land use review, are allowing a new use that potentially has safety impacts for the surrounding area because it doesn't meet code, I think that is a nexus.
I can, yeah, the fire thing, that makes sense.
Yeah, and that's where we were looking, I think, primarily at things like fire.
Potentially seismic upgrades and impacts on, if in the case of an earthquake.
And particularly given it's a place of public assembly, you know, those concerns, I think, are sort of amplified somewhat. In terms of the questions for 33-800-070, I think I would stress the or in that statement. So conditions may be applied only to ensure the proposal will conform to the applicable approval criteria for the review or to ensure the enforcement of city regs. So at least what 800-070 is saying, you can put conditions on that in fact aren't associated with the approval criteria if you're doing it to ensure conformance with other city regulations. And I'll grant it, that isn't a aspect of the code that we use frequently, but certainly for other land use reviews, it's not uncommon for us to require a building permit with a set time frame in order to ensure that something on the property is done. You know, typically it's more physical, you know, improvements that were required through the land use review.
Okay. Thank you, that was helpful.
Thanks.
Okay, back to you, Mr. Hall.
All right, so to unpack that a little bit, let's tether it back to the language of the code that we're analyzing for a nexus. 33-815-105(3)(2). Absent a significant adverse impact on the livability of nearby residential zone lands, that is not implicated. Again, we're not proposing to change anything. We take issue with, there's a factual dispute about whether or not there is a new use. You heard Mrs. Engelman say that there's been a number of historical uses on this site. It is historically a community gathering place. It is historically a church. It has continued to be a church since well, and have religious uses since well past 2012, as was reported by the staff. And we'll get there's more slides on that to come. So the idea of a new use, we disagree with. The idea of just safety as a generalized thing that can be applied and result in a condition of approval requiring millions of dollars of work on a 12-month timeline, we disagree with as well. So that's how we get to the essential nexus standard. And again, somehow the status quo is going to have a significant adverse impact on the livability of nearby residential lands, despite the fact that this building has been there since 1945. That's what you need to believe to follow that particular path. So if we could go to the next slide. So the follow-on to the Nolan argument is the Dolan argument. If we're really just imposing, porting in a requirement to do millions of dollars of work within 12 months, you know, we don't believe that's roughly proportional to the impacts of the application. The impacts of the application are low. We're not proposing to change the building. We're proposing to continue existing uses, which we do believe are approved and have conditional use status, which we will be talking about later in detail. And again, it's the city's burden to provide evidence on these issues. The city has provided none. The evidence in the record are that it demonstrates that the Abbey has been improving the building and doing what it can with the funds that are available to make sure that it is a safe environment and that it is a safe environment. The Abbey has, over the past number of years, pulled permits from the city to do some interior improvements associated with its operations and gone through that process and inspections and everything associated with that. This is being framed to you as some action that's in lieu of enforcement proceedings. We don't believe that's the case. If the city decided to bring enforcement proceedings, we think we have very good defenses. We do agree that it's good to kind of get all of this clarified through this process that we're undertaking, so a new land use approval is what allows everyone to go forward kind of scot-free. We think that's a great objective. However, we can't bankrupt the Abbey to get there. So that's why we need to engage in this kind of pushback with staff and ensure that the Abbey's rights are protected. The other thing about, I just want to circle back to that generalized standard, the catch-all at 33800070, it kind of came to me when folks were speaking. If we're talking about to ensure the enforcement of other city regulations. So if it's the city's position that a condition or a change of approval permit is required, there's a standard that says when those are required. So if they say you should obtain that, if that's what's being enforced, there's no timeline associated with the structural code standards. That's purely added in from whole cloth into this condition of approval, and staff has mentioned as much. They asked the buildings permit folks, what's the kind of timeline you think it would take? And they got a 12-month answer. I'm not sure what went into that, but it's not practical or feasible, and it doesn't give us a workable outcome, which is land use approval that clarifies these issues that is actually tenable for us to proceed with.
So do I take it there's an actual dispute between you and the city about what you would have to get under condition E?
I don't think that the city's taken a position on the breadth of that. I think that we're ready to, I'm going to ask that the record be held open, and we're ready to present evidence based on our analysis from our architect of what the scope of that would be and what the associated costs would be. That work and initial feedback is that it is, they're talking about seven figures of work.
So is that like something you think that I'm gonna have to decide whether or not you need a change of occupancy or not, or okay?
It has been determined that the change of use will require a change, a building permit.
Right, or there might be some stuff under that. Some of the city regulations, am I gonna have to decide that? Because I'm not sure that's what's supposed to be going on here.
I think that what we're asking to decide is whether it's in or out, right? You have staff saying, hey, we have every right to, as a city, put this condition of approval here. I'm saying that it's not applicable to our current review. I mean, as far as the logistics of what would need to go into the building permit and what actual improvements, I think, consistent with what I'm saying, that's all structural code stuff. That's all handled through the building permit process. I don't think that's part of this proceeding.
Okay.
I think that's, this dispute is kind of a byproduct of importing outside standards into the land use process and kind of trying to shoestring those on and by like matching words like safety, says safety here, and kind of coming up a little bit short and not having the evidence to back those positions up or to demonstrate any kind of rough proportionality. If we could do the next slide, that'd be great. So existing conditional uses, church use, event and community gathering space, and offices have all been traditional uses of the historic structure going back to 1945. Staff would say it's just a religious institution, which is not even a defined use back then, and there's nothing else happening here. There's nothing to see. However, we've gone through a landmark designation process, and done a bunch of research looking at what has actually happened in this building. And a whole lot of things have been happening and continue to be happening in these buildings. So if you put them into the categories of the land use code, what you actually get is things that have over time become automatic conditional uses. So I'm pointing you your attention to 33815030, and basically says as zoning changes over time, things that were initially allowed and that become non-conforming uses or are still allowed but then become conditional uses under the zoning are automatically granted conditional use status. again, this is not a monolithic analysis. This doesn't say that just because part of the building is used for the exercise of religion, that the entirety of the building can only be a religious institution. This doesn't change based on the user. So when congregations change, the use of the building doesn't change. This doesn't change based on the user. So when an after-school activity becomes a nonprofit, changes to another nonprofit, it's still all the same use analysis. The important part of this, the next step of staff's analysis is that everything stopped in 2012, everything was abandoned. There is a standard at 33815.050 that says conditional uses, if you stop the use for 3 years, you lose the status. 2 points about that. That doesn't apply to automatic conditional uses. The second is the use was never stopped for three, the uses in question were never stopped for 3 years. I point you to the underlined bolded language, and that's my own added emphasis. But basically, talking about automatic conditional use status, those automatic conditional uses may continue to operate, is what it says. Not may continue to operate subject to the standards in 33815.050, not subject to being abandoned after a certain amount of time. And the code clearly knows how to make the automatic conditional uses subject to the other conditional use standards. If you continue to read, any changes to the uses are subject to the procedures in 33815.040 and the appropriate approval criteria. But it doesn't say a corollary to apply to automatic conditional uses the abandonment standard. So I imagine we're going to have a code interpretation difference of opinion between the applicant and staff. But I think that the text and the context of that standard make it clear that the automatic conditional use status, that such uses may continue to operate, not may continue to operate subject to other standards that aren't mentioned. So I'd urge the hearings officer not to insert that language where it's been omitted. Again, as to the never abandoned part, in the open record period, we'll be submitting additional evidence. We've gone back and we've talked with the prior owners, and there have been churches operating, as it turns out. Not the large congregation that's been there since 1925, but the church has been being used for religious purposes. So the concept of it being abandoned and the use allowances going away, we think is inaccurate, and we will prove that out. Next slide. So the follow-on from that, this is the interior of the church and auditorium space. As mentioned, 400 person capacity. There's a kind of balcony as well with a modicum of capacity there. Just to remind you, we are talking about a church, and the exercise of religion has a particular place in land use. It's not something that the city gets to say what is or is not the exercise of religion. It's not something that gets to be said goes away automatically because of operation of land use standards. So with the apology that this is about to get be a very wordy slide, could we go to the next one? All right, so you're familiar with the Religious Land Use Institutionalized Persons Act, our LUPA. I will summarize. Basically, local government can't burden the exercise of religion without making some findings, and those are A and B. There has to be in furtherance of a compelling government interest, and it has to be the least restrictive means of furthering that compelling government interest. No such findings exist in the record. I would submit that saying that you can only use just over half the capacity of an existing church is a significant burden to the free exercise of religion in that facility. More quotations from the federal law, our LUPA. It needs to be construed in favor of broad protections of religious exercise to the maximum extent permitted. under the Constitution and that federal law protecting the exercise of religion. And to the extent that a standard is inconsistent with our LUPA, I'm not 100% sure we even have the standards to be inconsistent. We can make decisions that are very reasonable to say that we don't actually have to cap the use at 250. The government can avoid those standards. So to the extent that you feel that the rationale under the public facility standard related to on-street parking is ironclad and can't be pushed back on, our LUPA dictates it should be set aside. So let's go to the next. And so this is the last slide, and I'll wrap it up. I'm just stepping back so that we can talk about these impacts kind of cumulatively, in a cumulative fashion, I guess. We've got a condition requiring immediate and significant building upgrades at significant cost. We've got a commission limiting event attendance and significantly reducing the Abbey's revenue. Those two things are completely at odds. Even if the number comes back as something the Abbey could afford, we're still imposing restrictions on business that would preclude the Abbey from affording it. So just as a practical matter, it doesn't make sense. I get these things are somewhat siloed within the city, within city bureaus, but unfortunately they're landing on your desk today. Also, I'd like to say how these issues are inconsistent with city policy. The preservation incentive review is intended to increase the potential for historic landmarks such as the Abbey to be used, protected, renovated, and preserved. Putting a seven-figure tag on continued use is inconsistent with that. What it does is recalibrate the economic incentives for it to be knocked down and be repurposed and redeveloped. Also, taking a look at the applicable neighborhood plans, the King neighborhood dictates policies and objectives that including creating opportunities for artists and entertainers to live and work in the King neighborhood and establishing an art and multicultural center in the King neighborhood. We think that imposing conditions of approval that would put the Alberta Abbey out of business are inconsistent with those. And then we think that this is inconsistent with community values. You have in the record testimony from both the King Neighborhood Association and the Humboldt Neighborhood Association giving full-throated support of the Abbey, even to the point of, saying conditions B and condition E are untenable, work with them. The posture of the staff report is that these conditions are somehow protecting the neighborhood from undue impacts and, of various flavors. That's inconsistent with the evidence in the record, and it's also inconsistent with the track record of the Abbey of being a good neighbor. Again, this is not something new. This is something that's been operating in this neighborhood. I believe they started it was just a basement and there was no church above it in 1925. This particular building got built in 1945. It has been actively used since then. This is not something where there's a whole set of brand new impacts that we need to analyze and that are gonna be something that the neighborhood didn't see happen. I mean, you specifically have a list of all the events that have happened at the Abbey under the current operational guidance of the Alberta Abbey in its current form in the last 2 years. That has not raised a number of significant concerns, and to the extent there are folks here who are in opposition, I'll respond to what they have to say, but I'm not 100% sure that I see anyone that fits that description. So unless you have any questions, I would like to reiterate a request to hold the record open and we can talk more about that on rebuttal.
Okay, yeah, we can discuss the open record period at the end. And I assume you're gonna get into this during the open record period, but so on the condition E, assuming that there's some things that eventually need to be done, are you suggesting any sort of timeline or just you guys don't have to do that at all? Or I know there's a dispute about what you may or may not have to do, but assuming you probably have to do something, Do you have a timeline?
Our preferred outcome would be that there's just no condition about change of occupancy permits. We think that there are, the record doesn't prove out that that is necessary. To the extent that there needs, you find, you feel otherwise and feel the need to impose a condition, you know, something along the lines of get all of the permits that you need, without being prescriptive as to what exactly the permit is or as to what exactly the timeline. You know, I think that we could ultimately live with that. Again, it's not that we want to disengage from the city and not improve the building. That is certainly part of the mission of the Abbey, is to keep that building safe and to and enjoy events there and not incur the wrath of the city enforcement folks. But and you also have in the record in that same memorandum for me a list of improvements that have been happening and continue to be ongoing. So we're acting in good faith here. We just can't work with the particular condition that's been proposed.
So the way it says now, it says Alberta Abbey will apply for all required building permits to accomplish the appropriate change of occupancies of the building. So if you didn't have the part about the timeline, 6 and 12 months, would that part be okay? Because then it would sort of be up to be determined what.
If you changed might all to any, I think that would be more appropriate.
Okay. And so you would be okay with that, and then assuming, but if there are some that are necessary, do you not think there should be any time things, like even if it's not 6 and 12, if you're like 2 years for you, I mean, you think it should be completely open-ended? And so if it's
I think it should. I mean, this is not a situation that's particularly unique, and it's not a situation that involves our particular land use review. The city has plenty of levers to pull to enforce its building code to the extent it thinks it's being not followed. You know, we don't think that that is the case here, and as is evidenced by the record, we've sat down with the city, we've had discussions, we're going back and figuring out what it is that means. But these are, you know, existential price tags as far as the Abbey's concerned. So to the extent we don't need to be boxed in, because there is at this point no evidence in the record of what needs to be done on the building permit side, I think then we should avoid that, because it's not really part of this land use proceeding.
Okay, thank you. And one other question, going back to the off street parking, the 85 versus 95, and you were saying that under the one provision that you can balance 11 of the 12 factors. And so let's just say, for sake of argument, agree with you on that, and you get through that, okay. But once you get to the adjustment to eliminate the need for offsite, the 133 spots, then wouldn't that come back into play anyway? And I'd have to decide, battle of the traffic experts, between 85 and 90%.
I think that there is reference in the adjustment findings to that particular standard or that particular condition of approval B. I think, you know, there is a path that you could balance 11 out of 12 and get to no condition of approval. But, you know, I think we're what the Abbey has proposed as far as a reasonable cap with a reasonable ability to exceed that cap if parking is available. You can plug that in for the exact same rationales as the proposed condition. But then, you know, the crux of the adjustment finding really is that the standard is that no parking would be required if we were within, I believe it's a certain proximity to a transit line that operates I think it's every 20 minutes, and then the standard would be zero parking that's required on site. We're 40 feet away from that. It's on MLK. So that's really the rationale that's driving that, you know, we're not doing any harm here kind of analysis. It's not having a larger impact, and it's not inconsistent with the purpose of the standards. I'm glad to bolster that response. There are a number of places where it talks about the the 250-person cap being beneficial to, or you know, just generalized livability and not having the different flavors of ways of saying not impacting the neighborhood. But again, this is not a new use. These are not new people coming and parking that haven't been parking in the neighborhood for decades. We get back to the practical side of what really is the livability analysis that we're proposing to apply. And I'm glad to point back to the language of the code on all of that. And I think that just replacing the 250 cap with the proposed condition of approval, we still satisfy those other standards where staff has either mentioned or relied on condition of approval B.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else from your team, or is that concluded for you guys?
That's it.
Okay. Is there anybody else who's not part of the applicant's team but still wants to testify in favor of the application?
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Richard Hunter, Sr., H-U-N-T-E-R. I live at 415 Northeast Fargo Street, number 156. And I was born and raised here in Northeast Portland. I was born here in 1953. And I've been, you know, familiar with everything that's been going on with this building for all that time. And I've even had an opportunity to I serve as an associate pastor at the church that I belong to, a neighborhood Church of God. And at one time, we were a partner with the church, the original church. And we operated many different facets of programs out of the building. We had the Oregon Human Rights Coalition had an office there. We operated a program for children during the summertime. There was also a job training program for youth. And so many different entities that provided a platform for this community to enrich the lives of the African Americans that predominantly occupy that community. I since retired from Oregon Department of Transportation in 2015, and one of the things I wanted to do was to become more actively involved in my community. And since I've retired, one of the best avenues that I have found to stay connected to my community is through the Alberta Abbey, because they are doing what we used to do. And I stay real connected to the African American community. I'm involved. I went to the hear Dr. Barber speak that was brought in by the Meyer Trust, and man, I was just, you know, I don't know if you know who he is, but if you do the research on him, you'll find that he is a significant individual in the country. I think I go to Alberta Abbey for events maybe several times a month, if not more, and. And I have to say that although there's a lot of multicultural things, most of the things that I've attended have been African American centralized. And you know, so much has been taken away from the African American community through gentrification and other avenues that are not conducive to the building the community, mostly tearing down. Alberta Abbey has been a focal point to bring African American organizations and stuff together. And, you know, and multiculturally, they have been awesome. You know, I just wish that, you know, the when you consider the historical significance of Alberta Abbey, that they're not doing anything different that hasn't been done for the last 50 years. And we need to see that continue. Because I don't know what, I'm very actively involved in the community. I'm on the, I'm an at-risk board member for the Humboldt Neighborhood Association, which share border lines with King Neighborhood Association. And we have both been actively involved. The Alberta Abbey has housed a lot of meetings for neighborhood associations, have housed meetings for, you know, the Soul District, which is mostly an organization that promotes a lot of black-owned or African-American-owned businesses in the community. And everything that I've attended have always been to bring people together and enhance and support the community and keep it a place that's affordable for all the multicultural activity that they do. And I just I don't know what could happen. I think it would be a lost cause if this doesn't continue, because it's needed, it's helpful, and it does preserve a lot of the history of the services that have been provided in this community for over the last 50, 60 years. So that's, I need it because that's my way of staying connected to my community, is through the Alberta Abbey and the coffee shop.
So, okay. Well, thank you very much. So I'll take that as strongly in favor. So.
Okay. Yes, strongly in favor.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Is there anybody else who's in favor who'd like to testify? Okay, now we turn to opponents. Is there anyone here who's opposed to the application wants to testify? Okay. Ben, with Ms. Rhodes, is there anything you want to respond to now, or do you want to save it
for?
Sure.
Save it for another time. And I'm no debater, and I don't have my thoughts organized. And I do want to invite Bob Haley up to address condition B specifically. I did just want to start out by reading the criterion dealing with the transportation system, where it talks about balancing those evaluation factors. So it lists them and says the transportation system is capable of supporting the proposed use in addition to the existing uses in the areas. And then it goes into those 12 factors and it says, evaluation factors may be balanced. A finding of failure in one or more factors may be acceptable if the failure is not a result of the proposed development and any additional impacts on the system from the proposed development are mitigated. So
is this in the staff report? Or
this is the actual approval criterion. It is on page 12 of the staff report, listed in full under number 2A. It's the second half of A.
Okay.
So that is part of the approval criterion that PBOT analyzed. So, you know, it's not a balance of, well, it's only one out of 12, but it's looking at, you know, what's causing this evaluation factor not to be met? Is it the result of the proposal or something else? And what have they done to mitigate it? And, you know, PBOT can speak to this, but I remember back to the pre-application conference where we talked about the parking lot across the street, which I'll address in a moment. And we talked about parking agreements and how important they would be in order to get to approval. This was something that was daylighted for them very early on. And yeah, I'm just going to let PBOT address that more. But I did want to make that clear that the balancing is specific to, you know, who's responsible for the failure and what the mitigation steps have been. The parking lot is, it had been part of the site. It was under the same ownership. Historically, it served the church. The parking lot was moved into separate ownership with a very similar name. It's, you know, the Community Development Partners purchase of the property included the parking lot. They're now in separate LLC entities. They requested to move forward with this proposal without the use of the parking lot. The parking lot, as I understand it from neighbors and from my initial conversations going back to 2017, is proposed for development. When when CDP made the case to council to change the zoning on this property, they're looking to build affordable housing on that lot. So throughout this whole process, we have not been including the parking lot in the analysis. There is no parking agreement in the record. There's no saying, well, we're going to develop it, but not for 10 years, so this parking agreement is, you know, there's no parking agreement in the record. There's no discussion that the, other than the Kittleson memo, that the parking lot is on the table for being used for these events. So it was never considered in, and it's not in the same ownership, and it's not part of the site area considered in this review. So maybe during the open record period, they could provide a parking agreement. What we'd be looking for is a long time horizon. It's not, you know, having that available to park without, you know, and an understanding that this would be going on into the future would also not really address the issues. Let's see. Yeah, and I think, so for condition E, well, I guess let's talk about the use issues. So I said that the only permitted uses on the site that I'm seeing in our records are for a church, which is a religious institution use. We've got zoning code use categories and building code occupancy categories, and you know, I'm not trained in those and they're not trained in ours. What we're looking at, and both of them are relevant and apply, when you have any kind of use, regardless of what it is, you're also going to be dealing with accessory uses. So churches have office space. Churches, you know, might have a secondary primary use like a daycare facility. All these are regulated by the zoning code. And throughout this, you know, as Damien indicated, the site was a historical church. When the zoning went to single dwelling, it became an automatic conditional use. And in that, the language that he had up, the use could continue now that it was conditional because it was automatically granted that status. And then it's subject to 815.040, which is all the standards that under which conditional uses are treated. One of those is changing to another use. So going from a community service use to another community service use and what the rules are there. I'm not really clear on his case that there's still a religious institution happening. The site was sold. The building continued to be occupied, but it wasn't by a religious institution. It was an organization set up to support artists and artist organizations, from what I understand, through conversations with CDP. And those uses were never legalized. They never went through any permitting process. Zoning code planners never reviewed what they were proposing and designated it a use. So even if it were a church that purchased the building under A15040A2, they would be subject to going through a type 2 conditional use review to review the impacts of the new church use on the site. So from the city's perspective, the conditional use rights for this site expired after 3 years of the religious institution occupying the space, regardless of whether the building itself was occupied. Mr. Hall made the case that the section on when conditional uses expire didn't apply to this automatic conditional use. That's not how we see it, if I can find that code. So loss of conditional use status. If a conditional use is discontinued for 3 continuous years, conditional use rights are lost. If a conditional use ceases operations, even if the structure or materials related to the use remain, the use has been discontinued. Any conditional use proposing to locate at the site after that time of 3 years must go through a new conditional use review. So that's 33815050. So my initial conversations through an early assistance appointment with Community Development Partners back in late 2017. I researched the history on the site. I clarified for them that from the information they gave me, the church had ceased operations. There was no more conditional use status for the site. It had expired, and anything they wanted to do now would require a new conditional use review. At that time, they were looking at a community service use. So for us, it's fairly clear, and there in no way would be any applicability for our LUPA or any other federal regulations here, since there is no religious institutional use. So that's all I have on that piece of it. So there are no existing conditional uses, and from what I've seen, let's see. Yeah, I mean, there was a historic photo in his presentation of the gathering space, which is now the theater space with the stage. I don't think it looks exactly like that anymore. Of course, no one's disputing that this was a church and functioned as a church for decades. And again, yes, it sounds like there were a lot of activities going on there. Those would have been considered accessory if they were reviewed by the city. And, you know, from what we know, historically, churches were doing a lot more serving of the people right in their immediate neighborhood. Transportation impacts have increased for some of those uses, and what we're looking at now is really unrelated to what the capacity was of the and the size of the congregation, you know, when it was at its peak in the 50s and 60s. I don't have much more to say about the building building permit requirement. The site is already subject to enforcement. They have been operating without the benefit of permits through their previous owners and now through CDP since late 2012, early 2013, as far as I can gather. We have a complaint-driven system. As I looked for whether there were any code compliance cases that have been opened on the site, but if anyone were to complain, then they would be in violation of operating without change of use and change of occupancy permits. So, you know, they're already in violation if someone were to complain. The city does not initiate those kinds of reviews. I'm going to add to the record my copied history of the permitting that I, for the building permits that I found for the site, and a handout on change of use and change of occupancy permits and when they're required. As I said, in the G exhibits, I've got feedback from a May 2019 meeting that the applicant's architect had with our building code officials, and then a follow-up conversation in August via email about, you know, what the possible steps forward for them are in order to find out what exactly is required. But it was clear that they would be required to change the use and change some of the occupancies of the spaces. So that's all going to be in the record. I'd like to invite Bob up to talk about transportation.
Good morning, hearings officer. My name is Bob Haley, H-A-L-E-Y. I'm a land use planner with the Bureau of Transportation in this building, 1900 Southwest 4th, Suite 5000, and whatever our zip code happens to be. The applicant threw a lot of stuff out there, and I know a lot of it gets technical, and I'm not going to go there with them on this one. It might be shorter for us to say where we are in agreement. I think the 2.5 persons per car, when you're figuring what the demand is as far as parking goes, we're in agreement with. The condition of 250 to 330 was actually based on what the applicant had proposed. If you look at their chart of what they're saying in their memos, it was the average attendance, it was 250. The 330 was the upper limit of where at 2.5 persons per car you start using up all of the parking that's available in the neighborhood. We have to think of it in terms of, well, and the other place we're not in agreement is, as Amanda pointed out, the transportation specific approval criteria that talks about balancing the evaluation factors where failure of one or more can be balanced out if the impact that is failing is not the result of the proposal. The impact that's failing, the evaluation factor that we were looking at with that condition was on-street parking impacts. This proposal is what is having a significant impact on on-street parking, and therefore it is not available to be balanced. That is absolutely clear in the code, regardless of what you may hear in rebuttal. A lot of the other things that you're going to have to deal with at PBOT is also trouble with what is livability, what is significant impact. For us, when you look at the evaluation factor of significant impact, we use as a standard for PBOT for the city, whether or not it's a national standard, is 85% occupancy of a block face is considered parked up. When you have more than 85% utilization rate of on-street parking in a neighborhood, that is what tells us as transportation officials that there needs to be a proactive approach to managing on-street parking. Less than that, it's first come, first served. There's always going to be a spot on the block. You get more than that, if the neighbors want it, then we start looking at managing it. When we have a conditional use application that is creating that impact, we manage the conditional use, and we manage that by putting a limit on the number of events and the number of people that can come. If it was the result of a lot of new apartment buildings going up on transit streets where they're not providing any parking and that parking is spilling into the neighborhoods, which we hear a lot of complaints about in Portland, the way you proactively manage that is to create a parking permit system where all the residents get permits and it's signed for like 2-hour visitor parking. That's a proactive management of on-street parking. The neighborhood hasn't asked for that. We probably don't think it's fair to require the neighborhood to have a permit parking program and push the burden and the cost of managing it onto the residents. So in this case, we are limiting the number of events. The other thing that comes into play is that you're going to have to define is what is a special event. When we look at conditional uses, we recognize what we're trying to do is make sure that the proposal has enough parking that it can not use up all the parking all the time. And what we don't want a use to do is when they have special events is to create enough on-site parking for those special events that only occur a few times a year. Then it's just sort of a wasted space of asphalt with parking spaces, which we don't like to see in our neighborhoods. So we don't have a definition of special event, but we know, for example, if it was to occur every month, that's not particularly special. We would consider that a regular event that you need to plan for managing. So the 5 to 8 times a year still probably falls within, I think, what you could reasonably say is a special event, where we allow spillover parking to impact the neighborhood on a limited time in trade-off of not having to create more surface parking lots to take up residential or commercial land that we'd rather see in a better and higher use. So we also, so for that point, the 350 or 380 that the applicant is asking for, based on 2.5 people per car, 5 times a year, is totally acceptable to PBOT if you include the 23 parking spaces across the street. That is what it's based on. We have been told from the beginning that the parking lot is not in play. It is not willing to be a condition. So if you take those 23 spaces and you subtract the 2.5 people that could park in them, you're back to PBOT's original 330 limit. So if you want to go above that at 2.5, provide the parking for it. There's no evidence that they have an off-site parking agreement with a commercial use that they can use it on evenings or weekends. None of that exists. So our conditions are really based on the specific approval criteria, the nexus related to on-street parking impacts, and not allowing a use to come in and use up all the excess or surplus of on-street parking, which means the neighborhood that lives there, and this is predominantly in close proximity, a single-family neighborhood. Older single-family neighborhoods don't necessarily all have on-site parking. A lot of the lots are smaller. Some don't have driveways. People tend to not park in their garages. They use them for storage, so you've got a space in the driveway, maybe. But that's not what we're kind of getting at. We're just trying to make sure that the use is compatible and similar intensity than what would be allowed by right. That's sort of the whole basis behind a conditional use. Is your reason you're conditional, and we look at intensity, is to try and limit it so that you're not spilling out and impacting the neighbors. So. Amanda Rhodes is here. She's the traffic engineer for PBOT. I'm the land use planner. So if you got technical questions about how we came to those decisions and recommendations, we're both here to try and answer those for you.
So like all the cases I've had, we've just used the 85%, and it's just more sort of been assumed. So is that a magic number? Because I think the applicant's saying, well, we got to use 90 instead. So is how
I think the applicant is making the case that 90% is used on like large events, and maybe and to my mind, I don't know what those large events would be. Are they the Moda Center? Is it Blazer Games? Is it that level of large events where there's thousands of people? This is a, you know, a relatively small site, and I even don't know if I would classify it as a large event where you would apply the 90%. I don't know of any 90% figures in any of the literature I have seen or that the city has used. The difference between 85 and 90 to most people, it's not going to make a difference. They're going to see that it's really hard to park when I come home, or my guests have come over, or my friends are coming over, or I'm having a party that night and nobody can park because we allowed all the parking to go to this one particular use in the neighborhood. So no, there isn't a, I don't think it's a magic number, but I think if you think of a 200-foot block face like we have, you look out this window, there's 10 spaces at 20 feet per space. 85% is, well, you can't do it, 1.5 spaces are available. So both block faces, that's 20 cars can park. 85% means that when you drive down that street, there's going to be, on average, 3 spaces available. When you get less than that, that's just sort of the normal turnover. It's, from a practical standpoint, it's full. It's being totally used. The times you probably drive down and there wouldn't be a space available. What we're trying to do is avoid people circling around the block and getting further and further away, you know, spewing fumes in the air, all the kind of stuff, the wear and tear on our infrastructure, cars just driving looking for spaces. So, but again, I think livability and impact is somewhat subjective. We're using the 85% as a standard. Is it locked in completely? No, I think the hard part for this is PBOT is a recommending body. And fortunately for us, we don't have to make the final decision.
Okay. Because with the 85, with the 200-foot block, so that'd be 17 cars parked there. That'd be the standard you use. And the applicant would want to use 18 cars parked there. And I think you just sort of said that's basically the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. Not much difference. So why can't they use that then? Why would you recommend that?
Only
they can't
because
use that?
We haven't used it. We have traditionally used 85% consistently. And if we're not going to have policies explicitly written down in code, we kind of are trying to make ourselves defensible by being consistent from time to time to time.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Does that conclude all of staff presentations?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. All right, Mr. Hall, this is your opportunity for rebuttal. We could talk about the open record, too.
All
here. Amanda, would you go back to my presentation? So I think if we could just start with condition B, and if we go to the slide with the table on it, I think it's the there you go. You're ahead of me. Thank you. All right. So just to set the context on this, as you can tell, there's a history. Alberta Abbey has been working with the city on this and working somewhat hand in glove with the city on this to get through the landmark process and to this point. However, there has been a departure. The departures are driven by conditions of approval B and conditions of approval E. You know, setting all the technical stuff, which I'm about to rebut to, aside for a second, again, these are existential economic issues for Alberta Abbey. We're not here. They didn't want to hire me to make our LUPA arguments. They didn't want to challenge PBOT. However, you know, we got conditions that said, can't fill up your event space. We got conditions that said, you need to cut a check for seven figures in 12 months. So now we get into the factual analysis and the city's assumptions get challenged. And that's where, that's kind of where we are in this process. So jumping back into that, 85 to 90%, as you mentioned, it's not a huge difference in the number of cars. I believe I just heard Bob from PBOT say that. To the extent we have rights to the 23 parking stalls across the street, that they're okay with our proposal as far as the 350. I think that makes sense. If you take a look at page 12 of the staff report, there's a quote in there included from PBOT's analysis. The applicant's traffic engineer demonstrated to PBOT's satisfaction that large-scale special events that do not exceed 330 persons are expected to remain within PBOT's 85% occupancy threshold. And that's not including the parking across the street. So I think we're pretty well in the same ballpark here. We will provide you a parking agreement that shows that there is access and rights to the parking across the street. Of course, on the ground, that is exactly what is happening. If you, I think it was stated that, you know, none of the analysis includes the parking lot across the street. That's not accurate. If you go back to the Kittleson's initial memo, there are two scenarios, one with and one without the parking across the street. And of course, on the ground, the neighborhood, the community, event attendees use the parking across the street. So it addresses that. So I think, despite sort of how it was couched, I think we might be in the same place, and that the just the 350 number for the proposed condition is acceptable. The city hasn't really said much about whether or not it's willing to entertain the existence of future shared parking agreements. Presumably it would be, but they haven't also said that they're not able to do that. So leave it there. Well, actually, just one other thing on the parking. There was a discussion about the actual standard. Would you go back one slide, I think?
Sure. Sorry. I'm
yeah, that's the one.
Slideshow view.
Oh, no, it's all. It's probably easier if you don't. But so that, as far as the evaluation factors may be balanced, and Bob saying very unequivocally that the factors cannot be balanced if a failure is caused by the specific proposal. Again, if we all agree that the proposed condition of approval operates within the 85% acceptability threshold, or effective capacity threshold, pardon me, I'm not sure that there's a failure, let alone one caused by this particular proposal. Again, getting to back what caused this failure, you know, I mean, this has been part of the community for however many decades. We don't agree that this is all brand new parking and should not be treated like brand new parking. I think it's telling that it was mentioned that, you know, this is being considered in the same vein and from the same posture analytically as additive development, brand new apartments that don't have parking. So we think that it's a different posture that should be, this should be approached with, but we also think that we may have, based on testimony just now, found some common ground around what the our proposed condition of approval can be. I think, looking at my notes, I think there were just a couple of comments that staff made in their response is that I would like to respond to, just being very clear that Section 040 and Section 050 under the conditional use standards are very different things. The automatic conditional use standards do say Section 040 applies. They do not say Section 050 applies, which is being relied on by staff. We will provide you a factual analysis of the evidence of the actual uses on the site to demonstrate that you know, even if you do find that the abandonment standards in 050 apply, that they are not applicable here to the religious use. I'll track this down, but it was said that 040A2 basically requires a new conditional use if the congregation using a church changes. I think we're getting into some very debatable territory about the role that the city should or should not be playing, even if that is what the code says, which I don't agree with. And then again, what's functionally happening is staff is seeking to apply the current use standards and the current code to something that became a conditional use, an automatically allowed conditional use decades ago. So that standard of automatically allowing conditional uses was first added to the zoning code in 1977. So when that happened and the uses in the residential zone became automatic conditional uses, subsequent changes to the code do not limit the scope of those conditional use allowances, just like any other conditional use that continues on. So that's effectively what staff is saying to you when they're trying to assert standards under the current code and being like, well, we think everything that happened here was kind of accessory. Well, let's go back to the code in 1977 and see what it considers of accessory and whether or not these other uses that were sometimes operated by the church and sometimes operated by third parties really are accessory uses. So you can see kind of why I'm here asking for a little more time. We started doing this analysis. I'm confident that what we found has been that there's a lot of evidence of a number of uses on this site going back into the coal directories in various places, the business license histories. However, we probably would request about a month to get that all together to you, get you all of the shared parking agreements that we can get. We know that you have one in place for the 23 lots across the street, but we're seeking two other ones to finish the analysis of what it is that's actually being required by Condition E, both in scope and in cost, because that's not in the record either. And then, you know, call me optimistic, but potentially within that additional time, we may have some opportunity to find more common ground with the staff like we did here today on the parking conditions.
Okay. So you want, you know how the open period works. You want 4 weeks for the open record part and how much response and final argument?
Let's do 4 weeks, a week and a week.
Okay. Ms. Rose, does that work for you?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Let's figure out what those dates
are. Yeah. Would you do the calendar for me so I don't get the dates wrong? So we'll do 4 weeks, 1 week, and 1 week.
I optimistically didn't bring another extension form today, but can you verbally state that?
We will extend the 120-day
clock. My next question, thank you.
Accordingly.
So the open record period for submitting, I think everyone here knows how this works, but there's a first period where you can submit new evidence on any topic you want, new evidence, testimony, legal argument. That is 4 p.m. on March 25th. Needs to be here at the planning department by 4 p.m. Let's see, it can be dropped off in person, it can be mailed, but it has to be received here. It's not the postmark to get it here.
the response period is where you can submit new evidence, but it can only be evidence responding to things that came in during the first open record period. I know that's a little bit confusing. That period ends on April 1st. And then there is one more week for the applicant's final legal argument where they make legal arguments. They can't submit new evidence. And that is April 8th at 4 p.m. And with that, I believe we can close the public hearing, and the record is extended for those periods. Thank you, everybody.
Great.